Thank you for asking me to come. I mean, this all came about a couple of years ago. The History Society received some papers headed the Glendale Dispensary Fund, and they came from the 1870s, something like that. 20 earlier than that. We thought it might be very interesting to go through them. In fact, it was one of the funds that existed all over the country at that time to enable poor people, provided they were deserving poor people and had the signature of somebody important in the parish, could take advantage of seeing a doctor during 2 hours a week, 1 hour after divine service on a Sunday, and provided that all went well, that was their medical arrangement. For the next 100 years, up to the time when the National Health Service came along, slowly things changed. And what I'm trying to talk about tonight is what it was like in the fairly early years after the National Health Service. It was only 15 years when Jan and I came to work here in Wooler. And when I was a student, it was only 7 years since the National Health Service began. It was, to start with, I was just going to say a little bit about being a medical student in the 50s in London. Most of my teachers had either been on active service during World War II, or they were, if they were older, they were well used to the sort of mixture of private and insurance practice that went on in medicine and surgery in hospitals. So it was a very impressive sort of start to meet people like this. Being a medical student, it helped if you wanted to enroll in medical school. First of all, it helped to be male. My medical school only admitted women in 1915 for the first time, and at the time I joined, only 15% of us were allowed to be female, if I can say it that way. You needed A levels in, well, nowadays you need A star levels in chemistry, physics and biology. It was quite common, certainly in the 1930s and 40s, for students to cram the whole of science into a year at medical college, what this was called, the first MB. And one of our oldest friends I met for the first time had just completed this year, and he told me all about it. He read English and history at school, and then he decided he'd like to go in for medicine. And nobody, he went to a very similar school to mine in Leeds. It was a state grammar school. They weren't really used to sending people to medical school, and nobody advised him. And somehow he thought, well, Oxford sounds quite good. And somehow he got an interview, and he found himself, again, totally unprepared for any questions, being interviewed at one of the colleges. And he said, when the obvious question came, why do you want to study medicine? He said, I heard myself saying, to save lives. And the answer was, have you considered the fire brigade? I didn't realize I could do that here. Thank you. I've had him in a special way. But as he was, he decided to really study very well. But fortunately, London felt differently, and we were kept well away from patients for the first 18 months in London. I think in Newcastle, medical students start straight away on the wards. But at we were kept away, and we studied the science of medicine, anatomy, physiology, all these things. There were two important purchases to be made. One was a wooden box with half a human skeleton in it, and the other thing was a microscope. The skeleton I bought both these things from a senior student, and sold the skeleton the day after I passed anatomy. The microscope, actually, I kept, and we used it in the surgery until I retired. Those were the two main purchases that had to be made. After those 18 months, we went to the hospital in Camberwell, and the clinical time of being a medical student is really as an apprentice, and things have, I think, changed very little as far as I can understand. The first 6 months was spent on the surgical ward for me, along with half a dozen others. We were known as dressers. This is a Victorian term, but students were dressers. We took all the blood samples. We assisted at operations. We went to lectures. It was a very interesting surgical firm because the senior surgeon was Sir Cecil Wakeley, commonly known as the Admiral. This was because he had served in World War I at Scapa Flow on a hospital ship. He was, by the time I saw him, he was the senior surgeon at the hospital. He was known as the Admiral, of course, and his ward rounds were extremely interesting to take. His word would come, the rest of the firm were waiting on the steps of the hospital to welcome him, and word would come, he's leaving Harley Street, he's been seen crossing Vauxhall Bridge, and by the time he arrived, do you remember the film Doctor in the House? He was really just like that. We followed him at a quick pace up to the wards, and his rounds were taken at a fairly brisk pace, and his operating lists were legendary. The thing I remember best about his ward round was that one of his retinue was a nurse carrying a cushion which held a hot water bottle. And the purpose of this was to tell us that you never learn anything by examining an abdomen with cold hands. When it came to operating, it could be in the morning anything from a toenail to a brain tumour. He worked very, very fast, as his naval career had meant him to do. So fast that students helping him, two students had to be helping with every operating list. One of them was scrubbing, washing up before the next operation, and the other one was looking after the present operation, so you had to start when he began. During that 6 months, we spent a fortnight in what they nowadays call A&E, then known as casualty, and we had a quarter across the street from the hospital casualty department, and for the first time then we learned how to work night and day, setting fractures in plaster of Paris. It was a terrifying Irish nurse who taught us how to put plasters on and made us take them off if they weren't exactly right. And poor patients must have spent a long time over it as well. There were three fairly junior doctors who ran A&E and one consultant. That was fairly standard. Most of the emergencies in the hospital there went straight to the ward, so it's not like it is at Cramlington now, where everything goes through one door. One interesting thing was a doctor of independent means, a very experienced casualty surgeon, who would just appear at about this time of an evening when he felt like it, and say to the doctors, well, off you go, I'll look after things until tomorrow. I suppose he had a contract, but nobody ever seemed to ask him. The other thing I remember about that one day, going back, there was a local rag and bone man on Camberwell Green, of the Steptoe character, who always had his lunch in the Sun and Doves at lunchtime. And he must have had more than usual at one time, because he fell off and was slightly concussed. But he was able to get and drive the horse and cart up the ramp of casualty and went in and had to be admitted. And he said, what do I do about the oath? So we sent for the lady almoner, who was a legendary social worker who seemed to be able to do anything. And the horse and cart were duly driven away. We went on then to do other 6 months in other things over the next 2 years, medicine and all the other specialities. And perhaps the most memorable was when we were taught how to deliver babies. We had to deliver 20 babies on the ward and 10 more in the surrounding district. This was, the teaching was all done by midwives. We had special bicycles were provided for us to cycle out into the traffic with a great big basket on the front, not for the baby, but for the equipment. It was sometime along that time when I had met so many terrifying ward sisters that I decided not to be a research scientist, but to become a GP instead. I'd never actually met a GP whilst I was a student in training. We were supposed to have a fortnight living with one, and an arrangement was made, but he rang me up to say he'd caught mumps, and I couldn't, well, the chance never came again. But at that time, anyhow, I decided general practice was right for me. First of all, though, there had to be final examinations. In London, we were all told that it was unwise to go for the university MB examination without first taking the examinations of the Royal Colleges. I don't think they sent anywhere else. Of the exams of the Royal College of Physicians or Surgeons or Obstetricians, you parted with a fair number of guineas. But the advantage of it was that you could take the exam one subject at a time, and they examined every subject every three months. There was a written paper and then a clinical examination, going to a strange hospital and examining somebody. I think some of the college's guineas went to the patients who had interesting physical signs or stories, and they could be very helpful when it came to finals. At the end of that day, there was no notice on a notice board or anything of that kind. We all had to assemble in a room in Queen Square. I shall never forget this room. There was a set between and a going up to double doors. And we all waited at the bottom, and out of the double doors came a gowned figure with a clipboard, and one at a time we were called up by number and told whether we'd passed or failed. If you passed, you went past him through the blessed double doors, and if you hadn't passed, you had to turn around and walk down the stairs. And it kept us in overnight before finals. I started in London with a house job in London, and well, it was like all house jobs at that time. We didn't work shifts, we were just there all of the time. With obstetrics I was doing, and because there was so much night work, I did share weekends, alternate weekends with the gynecological house surgeon. But most of us had we're just on duty all of the time, except for a fortnight's holiday in 6 months. You did get very short of sleep, but there were compensations. The nurses were very kind to us. There was free meals, no slot machines, coffee, everything was available. And the 6 months went very quickly. And then I came up to Newcastle and did a medical job at the General. The General Hospital is no more, but many of you will remember it. It used to be the workhouse hospital, the Nightingale wards, and when we got busy, the beds were about 3 feet apart. It was, the standard of medicine was extremely good. That was where I met Dr. Christopher Strang. Now, Dr. Strang had work at the General. He had maybe 15 beds at the General Hospital, but he also looked after all of northeast Northumberland. The hospital at Morpeth, the miners' hospital at Ashington, Alnwick and Berwick, he did ward rounds, consultations. He was the only physician. I think now there must be at least 12. He was to be a very good friend to us. But by this time it was 1960 and National Service was on, so I won't say any more about that, except that during National Service, Jan and I got married, by the time we got to the end of National Service, we had started a family. Trainees for general practice now begin at the stage we went into the army. They begin with a 3-year course, a year of it in two different training general practices, and the other in different types of hospital job. So the training that we simply, at that point, I could just have put my plate up and started. But as it was, we did a little bit of moving about and working in different things, including my very first day in general practice. It was in South London. It was on the Balham High Road, and it was a Polish doctor who I met him for a few minutes before he left. He left the practice with his sister to look after. It was in his own house. It was in his front room. A patient sat outside in the hallway. His sister, she couldn't speak any English, actually, and the patients had to come within so many blocks, unless you were Polish, in which case you could come from anywhere in London. And the Polish patients were delightful. They were beautifully mannered. And at the end of the consultation, the men would click their heels and do a little bow. I never been used to that in Wilder. But it was, the Balham practice was fairly simply furnished. The doctor had a chair and a table. There was a glass case with a few things in it. The patient sat on a deck chair, which was very convenient if you wanted to be examined. You just put the deck chair down a few knots. And I don't know what happened to that practice at night. I went home about 8 o'clock in the evening, having done a few visits on foot round about, as well as the long surgery sessions. I think an awful lot of people were sent to the local casualty with a little note saying, please see and treat. The next practice, though, was a totally different experience, and this was up in the northeast, and in County Durham, an ironworks village, Stillington, near Stockton-on-Tees. It had rural surroundings very much the same as here, and the doctor was single-handed. He had a radio, a transmitter in his kitchen, unheard of. There was no chemist in the area, so nor was there another doctor. So his practice, he served himself all of the time. He had 6 children, and if he wanted to take them out on the moors on the Saturday afternoon, they had to install someone in the kitchen to summon him back. The standard of his care and his treatment was, subsequently I found it was outstanding. He said to me, though, as he left, he had to go into hospital for a short time. He said, I saw a case of measles today. We haven't had any for a while. You'll probably see quite a few. This was how measles used to be. Everybody caught measles, and then all the kids who were prone to it were put permanently immune and remained that way. So we waited until enough younger children had come through school until the next epidemic came. And by the end of the month, I'd seen 80 cases of measles. I'd earned the doctor 1 and 6 pence for notifying each case to the local medical officer of health, and they all had to be seen 3 times during the course of the illness. Fortunately, I mean, measles is a very nasty disease, but I was lucky not to see any complications. It was busy though. Newton Aycliffe town had just opened, and some of the patients on his list had moved there but had neglected. I don't think there was a doctor when they started, and I remember being called out one time to see a patient. It sounded quite urgent and was, but nobody in Newton Aycliffe knew where anybody else lived, and luckily I found the postman and he got me to the right place. And the only other thing I remember about it was, say, the doctor had a large family. They handed over one of the bedrooms to me. There wasn't a telephone in the room, and I heard the telephone ringing in the middle of the night. I didn't know there was a stair gate on top of the and I remember rolling, somersaulting down and picking up the phone at the bottom. Anyway, it was a tremendous practice. It was extremely cold, and our car was effectively a common van with windows in it. It had no lining, it had no heater. And because there was no chemist in the area, the doctor was expected to carry crates of medicine, cough bottles, stomach bottles, tablets. And during that time, the cough bottles all froze and turned into crystals, and the stomach bottles burst the glass. And I knew then I was going to like general practice. Through Dr. Strang, the word came that Dr. Bousfield of Willow was looking for a vacancy. And in January of 1963, one morning, I set off on this same car with no heater, no nothing. It was fairly easy going over the A697 because all the side roads were invisible. There were 7 or 8 foot drifts everywhere. The road itself was kept open. Northumberland was very flush in those days, and they had two snow blowers, each with 2 engines, one for moving them along and one for blowing the snow far out of sight. More about them later, but at least there was no chance of getting lost. And I met Dr. Bousfield at Lowick at Northfield and was interviewed over lunch. And then he drove me down the road to Ford, where we had a branch surgery. It was a sunny day, the snow was covering everything and the geese were flying, and I just couldn't wait to start. And we were lucky to get the job. A few weeks later, we both came up to have another look. And housing had to be arranged. It had to be here in Wooler. There was no nonsense about living anywhere out of the centre. We found a house. The plan was Dr. Bousfield would buy the house. He would charge us the interest he was paying in rent. And at the end of 6 months, if we liked each other, I could buy it from him at the same price. We didn't have a contract. We just shook hands on it, and that was that. And that was what happened. So I had some important people to get to know. Dr. Bousfield himself was a lovely man. He was very sociable and humorous. He worked very fast. He loved cricket. He played, his main relaxation was playing cricket for Tilside. He'd retired from this by the time we started, but right through the war, This was his only relaxation. It was said that if you wanted a certificate with no questions asked, the best thing to do was Saturday night, when he would go during the tea interval in his blazer and flannels, come into Buller, and that was the time to go. He had started here in 1936, so he was already very experienced by the time the NHS was unfurled. He lived and practiced from Hummelden House, which is in Rycroft Way. It was a pair of houses which had been built by the Lyon brothers, doctor and vet, and it remained the vet surgery until the 1980s, I think it was. His practice, it was after the Lloyd George Insurance Act, by around 10 years when he began, and the settled arrangement then was that panel patients were seen free, and the doctor got 1 and 9 pence for a surgery consultation and 2 and 3 pence plus a bottle of medicine for a visit. There was some private practice. He had other jobs. He was medical officer of health, and the panel didn't apply to everybody even at that time. It started off with insured men, and then it slowly spread to their families, but there were still quite a number of people who were private patients, and there were still quite a number of people who were not covered and who were seen without any payment. He worked right through World War II. I learned fairly early on about the feud between the two medical practices in Wooler. This went back a long, long way, and what caused it all in the first place had long been lost. But Dr. Jabour Senior and Dr. Day, who was Dr. Bousfield's senior partner, refused to speak to each other for many decades, and Dr. Jabour Junior started around the same time as Alan Bousfield, and they refused to speak to each other, and they worked all through World War II, all of them working 7 days a week when they could have helped each other out. There was a lot else going on. There was of course the RAF at Millfield, who had their own services, which were partially used, I believe, by civilians as well. But an awful lot of things happening. Hospitals stopped being infirmaries and hospitals and came together, except in name, to treat everybody. The foundations of the health service were beginning to be laid. And was the number of GPs left when so many doctors were called up meant that the work was very heavy. In Wooler, there was a question the other day about the clinic building just on the corner here at the end of Patchpole Place. At that time, it was a naffy for soldiers billeted in the village and around. They used to have dancers upstairs. And then later on, I think the building had begun as a council office, and later on we used it as a health clinic. At the end of the war, Dr. Bousfield decided he could take a holiday, and he said he used his powers to get the bus to stop outside his house and take him to the railway station. And I'm proud to say that that bus stop is still there, and it's now called Doctor's Corner. The health service began, as I'm sure you all know, in the years immediately after World War II. The plan was that hospital doctors would be salaried, as they are now, But GPs would be independent contractors, as they are now. And it was known as the John Wayne contract. You just, a GP had to do what the GP had to do and was paid so much a year to do it without really too many questions being asked. To begin with, GPs, a lot of GPs opposed the idea of having an NHS, as did the hospital doctors. The famous saying of an hour in Bevan about the hospital doctors, I stuffed their mouths with gold. With the GPs, well, they realised that actually their private practice would evaporate. They had really had no choice but to go in for it. But Dr. Bousfield himself was totally in favour of it right from the beginning, and he said he would never ever want to go back to the days of private practice and sending out bills and deciding who could pay and not. He would never go back to that again. So he was the first person a lot of you remember David. David actually began, his family had a little coal mine at Kimiston, or at least they ran it, I don't know what the possession was. But David left school at 14. He trained to be a motor mechanic, which was pretty far-seeing because there weren't many cars around at that stage. He was appointed in 1916, I think, Dr. Day's chauffeur. He jolly well needed a chauffeur. I mean, the cars were not very reliable. And anyway, Dr. Day did drink quite a lot. The other doctor was Dr. Bousfield's uncle, who was at the doctor's lodge at Flodden, and he had lost a foot in the First World War, so he needed to have a chauffeur as well. It was... So David started off as a driver. He was provided with a uniform, summer and winter. He said he liked his winter uniform. He had a proper cap and a padded jacket and gauntlets, leather gauntlets. But in the summer, he had to wear a white smock, which he said made him look like an ice cream man. He, as time went by, he told me about visiting Lilburn Tower. He dropped the doctor at the front door and drove the car around to the back, where a window opened and a pint of beer came out and a cheese sandwich. And that was how people were properly looked after in those days. Once Dr. Bousfield had become established, he didn't need a chauffeur. The cars had developed and he could drive himself. But a garden hut was put up in the garden at Homildon House, and that became the dispensary. And David was in charge of that. And then in the 1950s, a wooden hut was put up, a purpose-built wooden hut as a surgery. It was just opposite the house and surgery of Dr. Jabour, the Red Gables. And I had to get to know Dr. Jabour in a roundabout way, and eventually I'm glad to say we got on very well. To begin with, it was strictly only essential conversations. The wooden hut, well, Mary, it was on the site of where Mary lives now. It was built by George Cowans, the undertaker, and very well built too. It had three rooms. There was a waiting room, which was heated with a gas convector. It was extremely stuffy, and we didn't have appointments, so waiting times were long, and people would come into my consulting room bright blue about the lips. In between my consulting room and the waiting room was David's sanctum. That was his dispensary, and we had a wooden cabinet which contained all of the medical records. Medical records at that time were in an A5 envelope known as the Lloyd George envelope. They were almost entirely handwritten, but as letters, I mean, we if if we wanted to refer a patient to a consultant to outpatients, we hand-wrote all the letters. We got typed replies very often and in excellent English. But they had to be folded up and put into the Lloyd George envelope. So people with more troubles had thicker envelopes with gussets in. But this system went on well into the 1970s. David would walk down. We dispensed for medicines for anybody who was registered with us who lived more than a mile from a chemist. There were two chemists in Woolwich at that time, strangely enough. But we dispensed then for about half of our list, which would be about 1,500 patients. And David would, we bought all our medicines from Jimmy Bird, and David would walk down with the medicines in his suit pocket each day. If we needed big containers of cough mixture or something, then we would collect them ourselves. David ran surgery morning and night for 57 years altogether. He finally retired when we built our newer building in 1972, and he still went on working on Saturdays for a bit. And at the end we gave him a party, and he said that during his 57 years he can't remember ever having a Saturday off unless it was Christmas Day. He used to take 1 week's holiday a year. He'd come in on a Friday and say, well, it was Newcastle Hoppings week. And he and Janet used to go to the Hoppings, and he'd come in and say, well, I shan't be here next week. And we didn't have any other help. So he was just a wonderful man, a very intelligent, completely discreet. I learned a lot about people from him, but you always had to ask. He never chattered. The next person I had to get to know was Jean Rendell, who was assistant. Jean was one of the few lady doctors in Northumberland, married to the vicar of Kirknewton, and she did surgeries mostly at Flodden and sometimes in Wooler. And she did clinics, baby clinics, family planning clinics, in various parts of the district. She just knew everybody. Her Saturday night surgeries did try David's patience a bit, because they went on till about 8:30 to 9 o'clock, and he didn't think it was always the medicine that they were talking. The chemists, they say there were two chemist shops then. Mr. Rutherford's shop was at the south end of the street, or the east end of the street, and Jimmy Bird, who was assisted by John Mason, who took over the business soon after we arrived, had the premises where they are now. John Mason was succeeded by Andrew Booth. But when you think of those two who have looked after this village, I don't think we appreciate just how useful our pharmacists are to us. They both served for a very long time. John and his wife Beryl lived over the shop, and they were stars in the local dramatic society. And their son Grant was very nearly Britain's first spaceman. He was on the shortlist, at least. Wooler at that time, it had a different air about it, I'm sure. I'm sure that those of you who've lived here longer than me might agree, with a much busier auction mart. Mart day was really important, and important for the Cottage Hotel, which was now the Tankerville Arms, in that the hotel and the bar was open all day. There was a butane gas supply throughout the village. Wooler had started off with the coal gas works, as you know, and this, by the time we came, we had piped butane all the way through. We had three banks. We had strange ways with the biggest grocers just on the corner of Ramsay's Lane. And Sid Simpson had the ironmongers. We had to go to see Sid during the first week that we arrived, because we'd never lived in a house. We'd always lived in a house with furniture provided. So we had to go and find light bulbs and this sort of thing. So I arrived at Sid's door with a long list, and he took the list and looked at the handwriting and said, "You'll be the new doctor, I suppose." There was a cinema down on the South Road. Dr. Bousfield said the purpose of our Saturday night surgery was to fill in the time between the shop shutting and the cinema closing, opening. But I started doing a surgery with my predecessor, George Quinn. I shadowed him for a week. He introduced me to most of the patients who came in as, "Here's the fellow who'll do away with you altogether." And we learned quite quickly what we were expected to do. The surgeries, of course, we had no appointment system. People would just come and sit. We had handwritten notes. I think this is where perhaps these rumours about doctors not having good handwriting might have come, because we did write a great deal all of the day. If you look at if any of you get a copy from a doctor to from a consultant to a GP, you will have no difficulty in reading it, but understanding it is as difficult as ever. They're all full of acronyms now, and unless you have to look up all of the acronyms before you get any further. But the honourable exception to the handwriting, I have to say, was Dr. Jabour, who had a beautiful copperplate, readable hand. We didn't do blood tests very often. There were no disposable syringes in those days, so any syringes we used had to be boiled and washed out. We didn't have dipsticks to look at urine specimens. We used a microscope instead. Dr. Bousfield told me I could prescribe what I liked, but it had to be wrapped up in white paper and sealed with sealing wax. And outside, I'll tell you about the other two surgeries in a minute, but outside each surgery was a box just open to the elements where people could come and pick up their medicines at any time. The practice telephone was perhaps the biggest thing to get used to. We knew what it was going to be like, but the phone was open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We hoped that anybody asking for a visit that day would ring before 10 o'clock in the morning, but it was a fairly forlorn hope sometimes. David was in the surgery in the morning and in the evening, but for the rest of the time, our wives were expected, without questioning or requiring payment, to take messages. Sometimes the messages weren't easy, really, to understand. If you're brought up in the town, you don't really know what the significance of a grape in the foot is until somebody tells you it's an agricultural pitchfork. And with a baby in one hand and the phone in the other, that was how my wife spent her days. And that went on not just for days but for many years before we learned better habits and got some more assistance. I have to say that wasn't until the 1970s. We did have an answer phone. It was quite a large thing. It just about fit on that table. And it would, we recorded our own messages. And so it meant that we did have alternate nights when we didn't have to answer the phone. We had a rotor. But it was basically alternate nights and alternate weekends to be on duty. We had the phone, but of course a lot of people didn't. in those days. It was with so many parts of Glendale being a farmhouse and a group of cottages. There was usually a farm. There was always a phone in the farm, the farmhouse, and they never locked the door, so it was always possible to get through. We had a sort of back to front telephone directory which gave the addresses first and the phone number, so that they could keep some sort of check. Either our wives or David could get hold of us when we were needed. We had a few other methods as well. At Chatham, the house called Park View on the right as you're driving in belonged to Nancy Headley, and it was known that I usually went to Chatham on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and she would hang a tea towel in the window as I drove past. So I can recommend that it's a very cheap method of spreading messages. We had two other surgeries. Now, Dr. Bousfield, quite late in life, married Marjorie, who was a widow and farmed Lowick North Field. They tried living at the doctor's lodge at Flodden, which I'll come to, and that didn't really work very well, so he opened a surgery at Lowick North Field. They converted the farm dairy into a surgery and dispensary. Marjorie said the farm insurance didn't really cover this sort of thing. So Alan took out a special insurance policy, which he showed me. On the front was written Dr. A. N. Bousfield, Public Liability, which upset him for some reason. The other surgery was at the corner of the Ford Road and the A697, where the old house called the Doctor's Lodge. That was always owned until recent years by the Ford and Eatle estate, and it was always let to the doctor. And there's quite a bit of this referred to by a lovely book published in 1879 called Leaves from the Life of a Country Doctor. It was by Clement Bryce Gunn, who became a GP eventually in Peebles. But when he was a medical student in Edinburgh, he must have been illegally allowed to do a locum for the doctor at the doctor's lodge. He didn't mention the address, but his description of the view was enough. And he had some interesting experiences. One night he said a carriage drew up outside the door and a very well-dressed gentleman got out. He had a dislocated jaw, so he rang the bell and said, He knew how to replace a dislocated jaw. What you do is to put the patient on a chair, stand behind him, put your thumbs on his back teeth, distract his attention in any way you can, and push. You've got to get it right first time. Mr. Gunn had seen all this in a textbook. He had the textbook behind him, so he could... Another even much more frightening episode, he was called somewhere where he had to cross the main railway line. He was on horseback. And he opened the gate and ambled across and tried to open the other gate, and it wouldn't open. And he could see a light and he could hear a noise, and he survived it. He managed, eventually he got out of the way just in time. It's an interesting, the rest of it is a wonderful portrayal. He could write very well, and a portrayal of what it was like, including what the weather was like, because obviously in the 19th century most of the winters were a great deal worse than they are now. The next thing we had to get to know was the other local doctors, the surrounding doctors. The Belford practice was really very similar to our own, and Dr. Byers was the senior partner. He was a very entertaining companion, a wonderful storyteller. He was telling us once about doctors being, GPs being paid in kind with food instead of money. And a farmer who owned a field next to the A1 said to him, any time you want a cabbage doctor, you just help yourself. So one Saturday morning he was driving up the A1 and he bethought to stop by the gate, and he was just looking for a couple of little cabbages. I mean, he had a conversation began, and he said it started, hello, 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 and what's all this? Now, he was police surgeon, but the policeman didn't know that. He was a traffic policeman. And he said, cabbages, officer. And he said, yes, sir, you don't need to go to police college to know that they're cabbages. The question is, whose cabbages are they? And he ended up taking him to the farmhouse, where his good friend said, I've never seen the fellow before in my life. I think the doctors getting food instead of it was much more important in earlier times. Dr. Park of Norham, David told me about him. He had the first car in the district, which was it was steam engined, and most of the cottages would have a pig killing in those days, so there was a great deal of food available for all. And Dr. Park considered the pig's face was his own property, and he would just walk in and take it off the wall, and sometimes the trotters as well. The other famous doctor who was in Lowick History Society have got a very good description of his life. He became the oldest GP in the country. He was in his late 90s when he stopped work. And he was in Lowick. His practice included Holy Island. He walked everywhere. And his retirement was only just a year or two before we came. Now, there was an even more important relationship with the doctors of Berwick and Alnwick, because of the hospitals, Berwick Infirmary and Alnwick, which were much busier, larger places in those days. Now, the 999 system did exist, but here in Wooler we were nearly always called to injuries and sudden illness. Most things we did our best to treat on the spot, but if a hospital was needed, then we had to decide whether a hospital the size of Berwick or Alnwick would be able to do the necessary, or whether it had to be the RVI in Newcastle, which with public with ambulance transport being undeveloped at that time, was a very big thing to have to do. The local hospitals at Berwick had a casualty department, and they were quite happy to set fractures, to do lots of things. They didn't have a blood bank, for instance, but many things were done there, so that was one much easier way of getting hospital treatment. For other things, for direct admissions, particularly for elderly patients, but for anything where very high technology wasn't needed, we could negotiate a bed at Alnwick or Berwick directly with the GP concerned. Some of the GPs specialised in anaesthetics and gave the anaesthetics for an operating list run by a visiting consultant. But there's no doubt that the GPs were on top of the management committee and managed to make things work their way. Ross Taylor, who was, well, he was the first transplant surgeon in the Northeast, he described the surgeon used to come from Edinburgh once a week for an operating list and consultations. He retired, and so Ross Taylor thought he was coming up just to tell Berwick what was going to be happening. But he said, I found myself in front of an interview committee headed by Dr. Jimmy Mitchell, who many of you will know. And it started off saying, well, you'll be coming on Wednesdays, of course. Mr. Farquharson always came on Wednesdays. And he had to say, well, no, I'm sorry, the RVI, Thursday will be the day. And they said, but you can't come on Thursday, we go fishing on Thursday. Newcastle was the nearest hospital at that time. There was no Wansbeck Hospital. In Ashington there was a small miners' hospital, which was, I think, even smaller than Berwick Infirmary. Now, the rest of our day we spent visiting. We visited every month the housebound. We didn't always get there on the day that we might have done. It could be any time of the day or evening. My January diary for 1966 has the names of 50 people who were visited monthly. And this went on for years and years and years. I don't know, it probably wasn't a very efficient use of our time. It was certainly much appreciated. And we did get to the byway quite well. And seeing how somebody is in their own home is a great privilege and very informative, even as almost as informative about talking to a local police constable about people. We got urgent calls for home visits if people didn't feel well enough to get to the surgery. People who were too ill to queue. Dr. Jabour across the road from our surgery, he had his consulting room downstairs. I think plenty of people have told me that they were quite used to sitting on the stairs, and everybody knew when it was their turn next. But children with fevers, for instance, wouldn't be expected to come to a surgery. Now, all right, this is a lot to do with measles and with scarlet fever. The last thing you want to be is closed up in a tiny room for 4 hours, or 2 hours anyway. On the whole, we got about six of these a day, and many of them were followed up. Talking about fever, we had a tobacco thermometer in those days. It was the mercury thermometer, and one of my patients said that her GP always kept his in his breast pocket, and it always tasted of tobacco. We divided the area up into two for visiting purposes at nights and weekends. Now, there wasn't an ambulance depot in Wooler. The Red Cross had an arrangement with Tully's Garage to provide an ambulance, driven by Eddie Wilson and later by Albert Hull, and a volunteer nurse, Becca Dinning, and then later on Beryl Buglis, travelled with the ambulance. And I don't know exactly when the ambulance station was set up in Wooler, but it was not in the 1960s. Perhaps if I can illustrate it, one Saturday morning, Dr. Bousfield had gone to Edinburgh to visit his wife, who'd broken her leg and was in traction for weeks and weeks. So he set off early in the morning, leaving me with the practice for the weekend. A patient who happened to be a doctor rang up to say that she thought that she was starting in labour, and it was quite premature that she should be starting in labour. The midwife went off to have a look, and I went off as soon as I'd finished the surgery, within a few minutes. And we got to where she lived, which was fairly remote. We decided that she'd better have an ambulance, because she had she was very friendly with the obstetrician in Edinburgh at the Eastern General, and she'd had all her antenatal care there, and she wanted to be there. But since she wasn't actually getting labour pains at that time, we still thought that she'd better have an ambulance, so we rang. And an hour later, nothing had happened, and we rang again. The ambulance came eventually from Belford. The Tully's one wasn't here that day. The driver was a volunteer driver. He had no specialised knowledge of any kind, and he had absolutely no idea where the Eastern General Hospital was. But we decided that the best thing to do was for the nurse to go with the patient, and I would follow them on, and we set off. And somewhere about Lauder, the ambulance pulled into the side very quickly, and we finished up delivering the baby, the complicated delivery, in the back of the ambulance. We'd asked Dr. Bousfield to meet us at Carfrae Mill so that I could get back to work. And he duly did this. I mean, things weren't quite so urgent by then. But the driver still didn't know where the Eastern General Hospital was. We had had a police escort to start with through Coldstream, which was not really necessary. But we didn't see them again. So Dr. Bousfield stopped a taxi and said, "Lead us to the Eastern General Hospital." And that was how it was. On this subject of pregnancy, we had three nurses who were all midwives, employed at that time not by the health service but by the county council. The maternity hospitals were at Berwick and at Alnwick, and a larger one with a consultant just outside Morpeth, and then of course in Newcastle as well. There weren't quite enough beds to go around, so quite a few confinements were at home, as had been the habit for many years. Nurse Mean was the Wooler nurse, and lived just round the corner. She was a strong character. She would say, little Mrs. So-and-so came along to see if she could have her baby at home, and I told her to scrub the floor, and I'd go back and have another look next week. We used the Wooler clinic for preventative care for antenatal clinics and for vaccinations. We were still vaccinating against smallpox in the 1960s, and diphtheria and tetanus and whooping cough. Polio came along. Well, polio vaccination had come in 1940, later vaccinations. There was a school medical officer in Morpeth who looked at children. So that bit of it, we certainly had patients I shall always remember. One of the first men. I mean, I'd worked in Newcastle for a year or more, and I thought I could understand what people were saying. But he came and says, "Yuki's an our co." And so, thinking to get information, I said, "Where do you get it?" He said, "Aye, aye." And Jan had spent less time in Newcastle. She had this to deal with over the telephone as well. Going back to the snowblowers. Early in February, next year, the two brothers Farrington were the two drivers of the snowblowers, and they each came to the surgery, unbeknown to the other, really ill with the tonsillitis and a high temperature. And I gave each of them a certificate to go home. And the phone rang, and it was the divisional surveyor. And he said, "Well, if you're thinking of going anywhere, doctor, perhaps I think you ought to think again." And being Farrington's, they both got up and went back to work. I think visiting, one lady I remember very well visiting was, she lived alone, she was elderly, aristocratic, quite eccentric. The only time I've seen a donkey in somebody's kitchen. But the donkey, it was difficult to get into the house because the door into the kitchen went through a wooden outhouse, and the whole thing was falling down a bit. And she had a gander which was on the prowl outside. And I used to take a spade with me in the back of the car eventually. And I had to fend off the doctor. And the nearer the gander was, the more likely the door was to be stuck. I think quite interesting to what hospitals were like in the 1960s. Even the big hospitals of renown like the RVI and the General, there was no intensive care unit to begin with. In fact, David Morrison, who was a member of this society, who died very recently, was the bringer of the intensive care unit into Britain in Manchester. There was good resuscitation and anaesthetics and care of injuries. There was radiotherapy for cancer, but no chemotherapy. And generally, we didn't tell patients. It seems terrible now. We didn't tell patients if they had cancer. We just told them, oh, something might be nasty, but don't worry about it. And put people through a great deal of suffering, I'm afraid, in that way. But this was how things were in the 1960s. There was tuberculosis. There was a good deal of heart and kidney disease from scarlet fever. No dialysis, no scanning, and the treatment of stroke and heart conditions, many heart attacks, coronary attacks, was really not developed at all. The surgeons operated a lot on duodenal ulcers, and now there is a 3-week curative treatment with an antibiotic. No joint replacements. So very much, you can see how much things have changed in the last 50 years. In general practice, well, we had antibiotics. We had morphine and used it in the breathless patients with heart conditions. We had steroids, but we didn't know much about them. And we had an anti-inflammatory called Bute. Very popular. Bright red, so it worked extremely well. It was found to be quite unsafe to use in humans. And the last recorded human to admit to using it was the Duke of Edinburgh, who got it for his horse, but said it was very good for his arthritis. He got into a lot of trouble for that. We had thyroid replacement and insulin, and we had gas and air and pethidine for childbirth. There was a bottle of ether on the shelf, a rather nice red bottle of ether on the shelf, which was very useful for dogs. But it had been the anaesthetic of choice in Dr. Bousfield's time. We didn't have inhalers, metered inhalers for asthma. We didn't have long-acting morphine. I think perhaps most important, we just didn't understand the urgent care of stroke and silent heart attacks with something as simple as aspirin. So these things were not treated as being emergencies. A heart attack that was an emergency was one where there was crushing chest pain and collapse. A more silent one, we just let go and treated it at home. We never thought about adult screening or MOTs. And the people suffered much more, and life expectation was lower. But it was an interesting time to practice. It was a great privilege to be able to do it. The 1960s went into the 1970s, where we built new premises, took on receptionists, and became a bit more modern. Just to end with, one surgeon I knew well told me in his old age that you only remember your failures. I had one elderly gentleman I'd... excuse me. He was a new patient, a retired miner, and I didn't see him come into my room. I was in the treatment. So he was already sitting down when I went to see him, and he gave me a history of breathlessness, and I said, "Do your ankles swell?" And he said, "A bit." And I did what you must not do. I bent down and pressed his sock. And he said, "That's the artificial one, doctor." There was nothing to do but just laugh and start again. Well, thank you all for listening. I hope it's a picture of those years.